the I Don't Know More movement, the indigenous movement. This is a continuation of the, you know, 500-year-long indigenous resistance. It's much bigger than one piece of legislation. It's much bigger than, you know, Prime Minister Harper, much bigger than any one piece of anything. It's about this continual resistance that we got to a consumeristic, non-indigenous, non-sustainable way of life. We're trying to get our own people's consciousness awakened. That's the main primary goal. We have to worry about internally fixing our own yard before we start worrying about other people's yards. You know, discipline requires being on message. It requires living according to the principles that we're saying we're living according to, those indigenous principles. It's bigger than one piece of legislation. Half of these people, you know, they won't know, and the people that are in the mall, the non-natives, won't know what C-45 is, won't know what anything about, but then that's fine. But it's a bigger thing. It's about, as Native people, we're not going to be idle no more. We're not going to be silent no more. One person can make a movement. We can make a cause happen. We have the ability to do that. And if the traditional methods, legislation, legal lawsuits, et cetera, don't work, well, we could do insurrection. We could do other means. We have that capacity within us.
People were put here to protect our brothers and sisters, the nations of Salmon. And when I come on that console, the whole environment was destroyed. There were dams, there was silt, there was poison, the bay was poisoned, the headwaters were ruined, and we also had a piece of legislation that allowed us to sell our property. And right after that legislation, two of my beautiful young grandaunties were murdered for their land. There was a genocide, a total genocide of the Puyallup people, just mass murders. We were assigned guardians because we couldn't read, write, or speak English. They gave the land to each other. They kept the money for probate fees. They had the sheriff haul us off our own property. And the Puyallups were homeless on our own reservation. That's what this piece of legislation up in Canada could do to those people. And we had to do armed camps for our fishermen. We had to evict the state out of a hospital building to just be able to assert our rights, establish recognition, so that we could defend the salmon. All that just so we could do what Creator put us here to do. And we were able to do a cleanup. We were able to reestablish ourselves because it was our turn. It was our turn then back in the 60s. Now it's your turn. Now this lady that's fasting It's her turn. She's doing what any of us would do. She's doing what we have to do. You need to shout because it's working. You know, it's your turn. It's your turn. It's their turn. It's, you can't be quiet. If you shut up, you know what's going to happen. It's going to get messy, and there's going to be another genocide. So keep it out. Keep shouting. Keep fighting. If all you have is your body, put it there. Your ancestors did. They fought for every right you enjoy. Your freedom of religion, property, the resources. And you know what? Your great, great, great grandchildren will do the same thing. That's why we're here. All my relations.
What is I Don't Know More? I Don't Know More is a movement that started after the Canadian government ignored some of the treaties that defined the country and its relationship to First Nations people. Upon Canada's inception, treaties were signed that gave certain rights to the Indigenous population and lands, and it also gave some lands to the European descendants who were there. Until last year, the Canadian government wrote a new omnibus bill, or budget bill, as American might relate to it. So it took away some of that native treaty land and removed environmental protections for their land and many bodies of water and miles of rivers. Three First Nation women and one Canadian woman decided to do something about it. Someone must have said at one of those first couple of meetings that we have to do something about this. We cannot sit idle no more. Then Chief Teresa Spence of the, excuse the pronunciation, Attawapiskat of Ontario decided to do something. She demanded an audience with the Prime Minister Harper of Canada. He just did not respond favorably, so she went on a hunger strike. She fasted for over 40 days until the rest of the First Nations chiefs begged her to stop. It is our culture to take notice and act when a grandmother does something like this. Grandmother is the matriarch. When she speaks, we listen and we do what she tells us to do. Here in America, the natives have been through this betrayal of trust many times. We have been removed from our lands to make way for the stripping and pollution of those lands, all to create a profit for others. So we are called to speak out on behalf of our neighbors, and that is what we are doing. Because we know that this policy will destroy their rightful lands, flash mobs at the mall or Westlake Center are just part of the movement to bring attention to the cause. We must stop the big oil corporations from destroying the future for all of our grandchildren and beyond.
I'm here to talk about the cultural aspect, which I don't see a lot of in the newspapers. And a lot of the movement that's been happening globally, it has a spiritual and cultural base. We're not just singing and drumming out there. We're calling our ancestors. We're honoring our ancestors. We're singing prayer songs, healing songs, power songs. And not just for us, but for the next seven generations. And for each and every one of you, every person who's on our land in North America, and all across the globe, too. What I like about this Idle No More movement, it has a spiritual awakening. Our songs are being sung. As I said, there's traditional walks going on. There's a walk called the Quest for Nishiyu, and there's six young men under 20 years old, and one of their guides started it. And they were walking from Quebec to Parliament in Ottawa in 50 degrees below weather. And they're walking all the way in their traditional trade routes. And it's to bring spiritual and cultural awakening for all the people. There's recently a copper breaking ceremony up in Canada by Chief Bo Duc. And that was, in our culture, a shaming ceremony. He was shaming the Harper government for not holding and upholding and breaking their treaty rights. There's also locally going to be a walk to Quinault during our annual canoe journey every year. Every year a different tribe hosts this journey, and who's ever hosting, we paddle to. And I've been a part of the journey for many years now, and last year there was over 100 canoes that come from all over. So I just want to address this. That there's a lot of cultural and spiritual aspect that's laying our foundation for the work we're doing, that our activism we're doing. Recently, there was a historic Protect the Sacred Treaty, and this was an honoring ceremony led by Chief Reuben George and Chief Daryl Bob, who brought together Sioux Nations, Medicine Man Leonard Crow, Chief Orville Looking Horse, and they signed an unprecedented alliance to stop the tar sands. And what's so important, why this is important for us too, it's not just a Native thing, it's just not a First Nations thing. This is gonna affect us here. There's tar sands are coming through our lands, our waters, thousands of tankers, 18 coal trains a day coming through our towns here. And there's no cleanup plan. I would like to address that later. Somebody can ask me what we can do about that. But I just want to bring that to your awareness that this is affecting all of us. The global warming. Thank you. And what we're going to leave for our children, what we're going to leave behind, that's for us to decide. We can make a decision right here today. So in regards to the founders, have just put out a request yesterday or recently that they're calling for on March 20th, a day of ceremony. And this is, we have annual, on the equinox, the spring equinox, there's ceremonies that are done. And just to let you know, this is how we lay the foundation for our spiritual work, for the work that we're gonna do. And so all across, North America, people are going to be having ceremonies, lighting fires, doing sweats, water blessings, and we'll be doing stuff here too. We recently had one over here in Gasworks Park, a water blessing ceremony. So it's important to understand what we're doing there, and we invite you all to be a part of that too. At our flash mobs, we have round dances, and those are friendship dances, and anybody can join in. And I just want to let you know that you're welcome. We invite our allies to join us in this. So thank you for listening to my words. Lachish.
At the same time that Idle No More is absolutely about Canada, it's also not about Canada, it's about us. Because multinational corporations don't know borders, right? When they're gonna pollute the water in Canada, that water is gonna come down to us. That air doesn't stop at the border. There's no border check for pollution. It's gonna come down there and it's gonna pollute us. And so we have a vested interest in making sure that these waters are clean, that this air is clean. And so we started to recontextualize it. Well, no, we need to make sure that United States, people in the United States understand this. Moreover, we need to make sure that the first environment, something that plagues us in the United States and Indian country, the first environment that people experienced, their mother, the security of home, that that was something safe and secure. So we started to wrap it around the Republican obstinance, unwillingness to offer protections via the Violence Against Women Act, the reauthorization to the Violence Against Women Act. We said, well, if we can't protect this first environment, well, then we also, you know, how are we even going to think about this more global environment, right? We have to think about this first, home first. And so with the tireless efforts of folks like Councilwoman Deborah Parker up in Tulalip, David Bean in Puyallup, Chris Stearns, who's going to speak later on, we've had an educational process explaining that in the same way that Idle No More is not a Native issue. I want you guys, if you guys don't walk away with anything else, to my non-Native sisters and brothers, I want you guys to walk away with this. Idle No More has nothing to do with being Native, and I'll explain why. It is definitely, the genesis is within the Native community, but it has nothing to do with Native people. I mean, we don't own it. And the reason why is this. For the same reason that the border doesn't stop pollution from coming in, non-Native kids, Native kids, white, black, Mexican, doesn't matter. All of our children have a vested interest in having clean drinking water, right? All of our children have a vested interest in clean air so that they can breathe. That's something that affects everybody. Moreover, the Republican opposition, that first environment, again, the Republican opposition to the Violence Against Women Act, by doing that, it was interesting. They put a line in the sand and said, we're not only refusing to protect Native women from rape, stalking, sexual violence, because that's exactly what they said, but we're also not going to protect any women. And so that reauthorization that didn't happen in 2012 for the first time since 1994, it didn't happen for any of you women in the audience, Native or non-Native. This has nothing to do with being Native or non-Native. This has to do with protection of our land, protection of our water, protection of women, the first environment that children experience, that security. And so it was within that context that we wanted to make art and do some organizing around art and show people that this is something that's sort of universal. All of us have this vested interest. This first piece that we did, it was an introductory piece. And it was kind of, fair to say, kind of lightning in a bottle, right, Brody? I mean, we just, you know, just went and shot and started talking. They literally, you know, hey, Jossie, here's a microphone, start talking. And that's what it was. And we caught lightning in a bottle because it was an amazing turnout for all you folks who was there down in Westlake. It was an amazing turnout. People turned out and said, you know, this, we don't necessarily know what the C-45 is, but we understand that the implications are bigger than Canada. The implications are better than First Nations, because there was a whole bunch of non-Native people there. We understand that this is something that resonates, something that has a ripple effect in all of our communities, and all of us have an interest in keeping these places safe. And we captured it. It was great footage. And it caught on, I don't know what the definition, if there's a Wikipedia, because that's the source of all knowledge, right? I don't know if there's a Wikipedia definition of going viral, but within a few weeks, you know, we had like 50-some thousand hits, and I mean, that's pretty good. And we're not going to get to this today, but I encourage you guys, when you see this video, go to Rock Paper Jet on YouTube, and check out the other video as well, because we did a follow-up video, which was entirely about children. Because if there is a definition or a small, small compartmentalization of the Idle No More movement, I think that's what Idle No More is about. It's about children. It's about kids. It's about future and hope and whether we're going to choose to acknowledge the future and choose to give deference and give that quality of life to our children or not.
Did you know that according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, a treaty is only good on the day it's made, does not prove recognition? I have to tell you then, from starting from the Canadian border down to the Chinook tribe, I guess we're not all recognized. And I don't understand it, but I'm going to share a little bit about the good, bad, and ugly regarding our tribe. The good is that giving up, signing the treaty in 1855 with the federal government, we gave up 54,000 acres. I don't know if you've heard this, but you know, the good is we own 2/3 of an acre. Yay. No, it is good because they burned down our last longhouse in 1894. We have a longhouse now. And I think I'm kind of honored because guess who our chief was? It was, they named a city after our chief. Wasn't that great? Well, what about the tribe? What about the tribe? Anyway, they made treaties with tribes, but like I said, they were only good on the day that they were made. That's pretty pathetic. It is pathetic. We gave up our lands, our forests, waters. We can't fish in the Duwamish River. I heard it's a Superfund, so watch out. Don't buy the fish there. Although I'm not trying to take away from people buying fish. And one thing that they promised is a bucket of gold. Never got the gold. Never got a res. We can't hunt and fish. Why do you want to be recognized? Well, if you give up 54,000 acres and you sign a treaty, yes, you should be acknowledged by the federal government. And so when they ask that, it just offends me because all tribes, why do we have to prove who we are? And you know what? When I got involved over 30 years ago and I was traveling, going to D.C. and going to affiliated tribes and what's that other one? National Congress, American Indians, and we all started working together, and there was about 13 tribes that were trying to be acknowledged. We're down to about three tribes, even though Chinook and the Duwamish were giving acknowledgement or recognition, I think it was 2001. And then Chinook's was taken away, and then ours was given and taken away. What is that? Now, I just found out there's a lovely lady here from Seattle. Her name is Sally Jewell. She's now the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Now, does she know about the Duwamish people? I'm gonna be hitting on her. Somebody asked me today, is she Indian? I said, I don't know, but I'm willing to give her a blanket. Well, the present situation regarding our tribe is they gave it, but we have a right to appeal. So we're on the appeal of that decision of 2001. And I think what we're waiting for is the judge to make a decision because they said that there were rules how to be acknowledged or recognized by the federal government. Well, we were told that we could go under the new regs. And we were under the old regs. And there shouldn't be any regs, should there, about anything. There shouldn't be. But anyway, we're waiting for the judge to say, well, maybe we'll hear some more historical data regarding our tribe. It's unfortunate that we have to prove more about our history. If they, and the thing that, I'm not gonna get upset about this, but they named a city after our chief. But they couldn't pronounce the Lushootse name. And you know, the government makes these rules that makes these reservations. You'll go over there and you stay there, and the same thing as Suquamish, go over there. There was not enough room for everybody. And yes, we're connected and we should, I like somebody said, that lady, what she said, love each other. Yeah, we should love each other. We should be supportive. We should care about each other. Anyway, I want you to know that if you see me down on First Avenue like Princess Angeline with my Indian basket, I'm raising money from my longhouse.
One of the things that I do is I chair the City of Seattle's Human Rights Commission. And we've been in business for almost 50 years. And one of the things we've been doing in the last 2 years since I've been chairing it has been, we've been looking at Native American and Indigenous poverty here in Seattle. So what I really wanted to do is just try and be brief and go through some of the things that we found. A lot of this is based on sort of three different sources. The first is, I don't know if Janine Kamenot is here, but she has a National Urban Indian Family Coalition, and they've done a lot of research The second source is the Seattle Indian Health Board. They have an urban Indian health center that also does a lot of research. And the third is us, me. Our commission, we had the real honor of testifying in 2012 in front of the United Nations on urban Indian poverty and some of the situation here regarding police excessive use of force against people of color. So just a brief some background on Native Americans. What this slide and the next two slides say is that we're a large part of the population. There are over 62,000 natives in the Seattle-Tacoma metro area. And if you just go by the census data on a native population alone, there are over 23,500 natives here. One of the things that I wanted to highlight is sort of where we are as a people here in Seattle, and I mean we, the collective Seattle. You know, we're relatively recent, but us natives, you know, and I'll speak for you all, because I'm actually Navajo, and I'm a proud member of the Navajo Nation, but we're from the Southwest, and we actually, you know, we swim and occasionally eat fish, but here, the people have been living here for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. Oh, yes, my wife, who's sitting up there, she wants to remind me to remind you that I was adopted into her tribe, the Tlingit Nation, last summer, and I actually have a name that's kind of appropriate. It's Tayagook, which means master of dreams. So, you know, we have this sort of, in natives, we have this sort of dual relationship with everything. So there's sacred, profane, but there's also sort of like serious and funny. So the serious part is that being master of dreams, you know, you really help, you know, understand different worlds. The funny part is it means I'm asleep a lot. So, which apparently, you know, it's perfect. So the treaty that was signed in 1855, that's not too long ago. Unfortunately, Seattle, being not really the progressive city that it always claims to be, 10 years later, one of the first ordinances passed here, Ordinance Number 5, prohibited Native Americans from living in the city. They could work here, but they couldn't live here, couldn't stay here after dark unless they were working for someone, the servants. So, and this goes into what I was just going to talk about, that really, you know, there are a lot of human rights concerns here in Seattle, and there's a picture of John T. Williams. He was one of the really motivational figures for the commission, and I also think, though, for some of the really good people who work in Seattle, they really took this to heart. One of the things that our commission did was we were able to convince the city to pass a resolution declaring itself a human rights city. And I'm not exactly sure they know what they did, but but every time we have a chance, we say, hey, you guys, there's this ordinance you passed saying you're a human rights city, so you have a duty to uphold it. So, and you can, you know, please let them know that they got a lot to live up to. So one of the things is that there's a recent international document that has a lot of importance called the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I'll try and be quick, but Article 46 talks about how everything is supposed to be measured, and when I'm talking about everything, I'm talking about things that Seattle does. They're supposed to be measured against principles of justice, democracy, respect for human rights, equality, non-discrimination. And when we look at, you know, the next few slides, you'll see that what things are here in Seattle, they're not great. And Seattle has a long way to go to live up to those rights. So urban Indians, you can see, compared to the rest of the population, we have 38% higher rates of accidental deaths, 54% higher rates of diabetes, liver disease, cirrhosis, alcohol-related deaths are way above the average. Urban Indians are 3 times more likely to be homeless than non-Indians. And something that we've been working on lately is education. Native Americans here in Seattle and in the state have the highest dropout rates and the lowest graduation rates. This is some more recent information. Just last week, the census came out with some brand new numbers on poverty, so we were able to crunch some numbers late into the night. And what we found here in Seattle is that Native Americans have the highest poverty rate. They also have the highest poverty rate in King County. That's almost 30%. And they are tied or for second with the highest poverty rate in the state of Washington. Across the U.S., the highest poverty rate in the United States. When you look at unemployment in Seattle, we're the second highest. African Americans have 13.3%, and Native Americans are 11.1%. Household income is the second lowest. We're at $33,750, but if you look at the average white income, it's double that. So there's a huge disparity. And this is probably the most depressing statistic, is that our Native American poverty in Seattle has actually gotten worse. We'd like to think that, you know, things are getting better, but for Native Americans, it's actually gotten worse in the last few years. Now, some of this is due to the recession and the fact that Native Americans tend to be, in terms of what they call elasticity, we tend to respond a lot slower. Most people of color do, economically. But as you can see, this is not something, a trend that's getting better, it's getting worse. So against those sort of grim statistics, you know, what we've asked the city of Seattle, and we're asking you, and we're asking our government, the president, President Obama, our governor, Jay Inslee, is to, you know, really consider meeting those standards that are set in the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. We have the right to be free from discrimination, and the right to life, liberty, physical and mental integrity, liberty and security of person. And those last two, liberty and security of person, are something that's really come into play. What that really means is we have the right to be safe. And as you probably know, with the way that the U.S. Department of Justice has forced a consent decree on the city of Seattle's police department, that right of safety has been in jeopardy and been endangered. You know, the first slide of John T. Williams, that was sort of the real watershed moment, but you know, these things happen every day, and not just in Seattle, but in King County and throughout the state. This is really important. We have a right to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standards of physical and mental health. So part of human rights is that they're not just things which really set a floor, but they're things which really set a ceiling, for this is what we all should be, what we should all be free to achieve. And we have the right to good education. Article 15 is really long, but the most important part is what's highlighted. And it's that states, governments, and so the city of Seattle is a government, state of Washington, King County, all these governments actually have a real responsibility to do something. They don't have a responsibility just to say, wow, you guys are screwed. They have a responsibility to really make a difference. And we get to, you know, we're the people who elect them, so we get to tell them this, hey, you guys actually have to do something. And again, another article, but the same point, that states have to take effective measures, and then sometimes they have to go beyond. They have to take special measures. So what we're asking them is to address those issues of unemployment, homelessness, poor health status, lack of education, high dropout rates. So this also is an important year. One of the tools that we have is our voice. I just love having the honor of talking to people and asking them to join with us. And as everyone here has said, you know, you guys are with us. You're here. I cannot thank you enough for being here. There was an old lawyer who worked for Indian tribes back in the 30s, and his name was Felix Cohen, but he talked about how Native Americans are basically the canary in the coal mine, and you know how a country, how a state, how a city treats the worst of them, that's us, how we're the worst off, is really how that state, that city, that country is going to treat you. And so we're all in this together. You know, I one of the things I love is there's that phrase about rising tide lifts all boats, which is what we're hoping for. But the other thing is that a sinking tide reveals those who are swimming without swim trunks.
Yeah.
So what I really, you know, I just wanted people to be aware that, you know, there are some really concrete numbers, because at the end of the day, when we're trying to move public policy, when we're trying to move officials, when we're trying to move the media, the institutions in the United States, it's important to be passionate, but it's also important to have the facts and the figures to back us up, because you know, the facts don't lie. So that's really important. I'm really honored to be here, and I just want to thank again everyone else who's participated and who's helped leading the way here in Seattle. Thank you.
How does the urban poverty of tribal people differ from other urban poverty?
Well, first and foremost, poor is poor is poor, right? I mean, it sucks being poor. And that's irrespective of color, ethnicity, religion, gender. And so in that way, I always feel more affinity with a, you know, poor white person or poor black person than I do with a rich native person. You know, poverty is something that doesn't respect various lines, arbitrary lines in the sand. The difference, however, if there is a difference, because certainly there's a context, and poor people should certainly work together to try to develop meaningful ways of economic development and helping each other. And it's a community thing, right? That's a question. As a community, yeah, so stuff like this is good for all races to be able to discuss and talk about constructive ways of helping our poor. I see Ms. Janine Gray, the executive director of the Chief Seattle Club, who, please give her a round of applause. The Chief Seattle Club, for those of you who don't know, is a place that helps poor people of all colors. The target audience, the target constituent is definitely Native people, but they help everybody because it sucks being poor. And I am informed by my family's experience. I'm from the Blackfeet Indian Reservation in Montana. And when I first moved here, it was about 70% unemployment in Browning, Montana. When I first moved here, we were ostensibly homeless. And so those services are very important. And services, anytime, you know, we didn't care where we were going, we were trying to get some food. You know, you go to a black church, you go to a white church, you want a free meal, you're trying to get something to help your single mothers trying to help feed her kids. But the way that it's different, the specific question, is that there's a treaty obligation to members of federally recognized tribes. And that's just a fact. You know, whether or not it's fair, Cecile Hansen, chairwoman, she's, you know, a member of a non, or she represents a non-federally recognized tribe. And I think that is an injustice. That's a historical injustice. However, there's also the fact that on a dollar basis, there's money that's supposed to be intended for members of federally recognized tribe. And so in that way, every single time there's not these programs in place, so for example, Daybreak Star, United Indians All Tribes Foundation, which has a huge, huge infrastructure for Seattle's natives, anytime there's a member of a federally recognized tribe that cannot go up there and get some sort of services, the federal government is derelict in their duties to that member of that tribe. And so that's the way I see a meaningful a difference between the poverty. I don't think that one type of ice is colder than the other. Poverty doesn't suck worse for a Native person than for a non-Native person, but it definitely, there, the obligation part is a little bit different.
I would just add that, you know, there's a spiritual component to this. So, you know, as I said, you know, Natives are poor, and as Jossie said, poverty sucks. But, you know, you really can't make true progress in this city. You really can't heal the city until you have the people whose land the city is, who have tended this land, until they are well. When we're well, when the Natives are well, when the poverty that the Natives experience is dealt with, I think that is really the threshold for true advancement here in the city.
I was just going to share a little story. I worked with a number of tribes through the Small Tribes Organization. The Snoqualmie tribe is recognized now, but when they were still struggling for their recognition, I was in their office, which happened to be just a house they rented. It was on the traditional land, and one of the young men, who's in his 20s, he looked out and he said, you know, I was born 150 years too late. If I was born then, I'd own everything I see. I'd have three wives by now, and I'd be the richest man around. And so the recognition is very it's the Snoqualmies have been recognized, and now they're participating and starting to control the economy in their area. And you know, this is something that recognition creates this opportunity to get back in the game. But it's very hard for youth, I think all youth, to look around and say, I'm being denied the wealth participation in the economy that I should have.
How well are local politicians, the mayor, the governor, county executive, receiving the Idle No More objectives? Do they show any care at all?
Well, I can answer a little bit about that. I know there's an organization called 350.org, which talks about the global oil corporations their destruction of the environment. The mayor has done two things I know that are positive. He has chosen to divest from the oil companies on the stock market due to 350.org messages and the event that he actually attended here at the Benaroya Hall. He also has gone on TV and talked about the coal train, and he is actively working with organizers to prevent the coal train from coming through Seattle. So kudos to the Mayor McGinn, for doing those things.
I mean, it's Seattle, you know, so ultimately most people are going to be very, very friendly to at least the veneer of of some sort of, you know, the Indians are doing the Indian thing, you know. And that's cool, but there hasn't been a whole lot of substantive support. I mean, and that's not necessarily their job to support it. It's a grassroots movement, and it's always important to understand that. It started as a result of the folks that came in here with the hand drums. That's where it started. It started from people within our communities going out and making noise. And so we're not necessarily, absolutely, when it comes to the Keystone XL, there was a question earlier about that, or a statement about the Keystone XL, and we're going to need very, very organized help. But a good portion of this is just within our grassroots communities, taking our own inventory of our own lives and our own communities and making something happen and making the politicians take notice. It's not their job to, in a politically correct manner, say, well, we're going to support this particular Indian cause. We want to make it so that it's irresistible and they have no choice but to pay attention to it.
And one thing I would like to address, too, is I attended a Coltrane meeting here at Town Hall and found there's absolutely no cleanup plan here in Washington for the tankers or the coal trains if they should be an accident in our sacred lands and waters here. And maybe that's one thing our people here, our leaders, could take to the American Indian Lobby Day or pass some kind of legislation, ask our legislators to have a cleanup plan. Who's going to pay for that? You know, so it's there are things that we can do, because like I said, it's going to impact all of us, and not just us, but our future generations too. So it's really important that we ask them to act on it.
So far as I know, our local U.S. representatives and senators are on the right side of the violence against women piece of the Idle No More. Is that a correct statement? Okay, the man
spoke. It is, except for. There's always a but. I'm a lawyer too. So all the local politicians here are on the right side, and that actually includes Dave Reichert, who was against.
That's right.
But because of the hard work of Deborah Parker up at Tulalip, has switched his vote, is now for it. On the other hand, the two women and who were elected to Congress from Washington on the House side, Jamie Butler Herrera and Kathy McMorris Rogers, they are still on the wrong side of the issue. So, I mean, they need some help, and as does the congressman from the center of Washington, Doc Hastings.
So make some phone calls. Yeah. Make some phone calls.
And both of our U.S. senators, who are women, were foremost in pushing this legislation through the Senate. Good on them.
So the current safety net for Native Americans in Seattle has been in place for quite a while. Does anyone think that any adjustments need to be made that will change the life chances, improve the life chances for Native Americans in Seattle?
Well, just one really concrete example is something that happened in 2011, which was the Obama health care bill. And so right now, Washington has a choice to make, and that's whether or not to do what they call the Medicaid expansion. But that would increase the amount of services to the poorest of the poor and to Native Americans here. So what we want is Governor Inslee to say he will adopt Medicaid expansion.
Email him. Send him every kind of message you can. Your voice will be heard by Jay Inslee. I believe that.
So what is poor? Poor is determined by how much money you have according to the economic system. Tribal societies that exist outside the money system don't know they are poor. And if left alone, they have everything they need. Do we need to be rethinking what poor means while we address this problem?
I grew up on reservations. I knew I was poor. I was very well aware I was poor. And so, I appreciate that statement, and I had the richness of my family and all that good stuff. It's very fuzzy. You know, I had a fuzzy family, the Section 8 Indian family, right? But for the welfare Brady Bunch. I appreciate that statement, but the reason why it makes a difference is because in opportunities for meaningful advancement, whether that advancement be educational or professional, and oftentimes socioeconomic indicators follow poverty lines, because if you don't have enough money to pay those bills, it puts a stress on relationships. In my estimation, you can trace poverty to the Violence Against Women Act discussion. A lot of the violence that happens against Indian women, I feel, is as a result of poverty, because there's stressors that aren't there in a lot of other families. Now, are there other problems in those families? Absolutely. But it creates tangible problems every single day. Poverty is something that, you know, it sounds cool, poverty bonds, and I'm very close to my sisters and my little brother, and we have a great relationship because we shared clothing. I shared clothing with my sister. And that creates a bond that, you know, they have blackmail pictures. I'll never forget those. But I think that there's a lot of collateral damage that happens as a result of poverty. And so, you know, I don't think that people that are saying, well, we need to have these opportunities are advocating for natives to be rich, because the polar opposite, it doesn't have to be the discussion. But what we are saying is that there needs to be a meaningful opportunity, whether it be for employment or for education, because a lot of the kids on the reservation in Suquamish, where my family lives, they don't even know that they have opportunities to go to four-year colleges. They don't know that they even have an opportunity to go to, you know, private schools, stuff like that, things that a lot of other people take for granted. And whether they choose to do that, they might not choose to take advantage of those opportunities, but it should be, I think, going back to Chris's discussion, sort of a human right, beyond civil rights, to understand that those opportunities are indeed there.
I also think it relates to where you live. In a country like the United States or Canada, where everyone is at this level of experience and life possibilities, poverty is measured differently than in what it would be in an African tribe that's never had contact with modern Western culture. You know, so I often said years ago that, you know, the Aborigines of Australia don't need a job. You know, so there's a tribe that was just discovered on the Amazon, and they certainly don't have Western culture, and none of them need jobs. You know, so it kind of, my answer to that question depends on where you live. You know, if people around you have the ability to care for their family and have food to eat, those are the measures and the comparisons that need to be made.
There are a couple things too that I wanted to add. One is that, you know, poverty is very cyclical. So, you know, the ability to break out of it has to do a lot with the ability for our people to, you know, contribute to our economies. And so when you have a criminal justice system that unfairly targets and discriminates against people of color, you really have to address that first. So there are a couple things that are happening right now that I think are important. One is that at the state level, the legislature is considering a bill to allow juveniles who are convicted of crimes to have their records sealed. Washington is one of the few states in the country where that does not happen. So if you're a juvenile and you commit a crime, that will follow you around for the rest of your life. It's tragic. And the second thing is that when you come out of prison, it's hard to get a job. The city council, led by Bruce Harrell, is a bill to prevent employers from examining your criminal record until you've gotten to the interview stage.
Yay. I would like to address the education of our children too. And I know I was talking to my sister here about who's from Nia Bay, who's Macaw, and they have a great program to support their youth there. I was really encouraged and happy to hear how they all their kids are graduating and going to the UW. So our people are helping our children are our future, so they're helping them continue on that path and giving them the tools necessary to see this through, what we're starting here, the work today. And also want to point out, too, here in Seattle, I've heard that the Heritage School, they're talking about tearing that down. I know it's been an ongoing debate and issue, but if we can get more people involved with that to help, keep a program here for our kids and a place to house them, that would be wonderful, because it's such a high dropout rate, and that's how we can break out of these barriers of poverty for our children.
Someone asked, what are the barriers to tribes assisting other tribes achieving sovereignty? What benefits does federal recognition bring to tribes?
Well, you can go to the state website at Office of Indian Affairs to read the benefits. I think you heard Cecile just hates that question, because there's no recognized tribe that's lining up to give away their benefits. It's a real tough decision, but what's really difficult for the Duwamish is the children have the same needs, especially regarding education. And the kids, sometimes we don't tell them what the benefits for recognition are, because it would be too painful for them to hear it. Last year we had a graduation party, which was really important for us. Any kid that went from one grade to the next was invited to the graduation party, and it was room full. But we're not seeing necessarily the scholarships and so forth that they're, when you're talking about the benefits at Suquamish, if they applied, they're not going to get a scholarship for being a member to a recognized tribe. So even if kids are staying in school and are A students and so forth, they're not having the same opportunities, and that's really painful. Healthcare, there are people that don't have the healthcare benefits that a recognized tribe would have. Just goes down the list. And the University of Washington, now the social workers come as part of their education to the Longhouse, and they have a class called Historic Trauma. And everybody's suffering from historic trauma. And that's the one group that Cecile won't meet with, because they ask such, questions are so invasive that they actually traumatize her. So, The element of these programs are to deal with the historic trauma. It's economic, it's mental health, it's physical health, it's housing, it's everything. And if you don't have those programs to help, the historic trauma continues without really an insight. So, and the economic development that's happened in the state. In 1960, there was no business on any reservation, according to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And look what's happened with the restoration of fishing rights and self-governance and so forth. It's just amazing. Even though there's still historic tribe and unemployment and so forth, and kids at Suquamish that don't know they can go to college, so forth, there's been such changes, and those benefits aren't available to the unrecognized tribes in the state.
What efforts are being made to improve access to education for Native children?
I mean, every tribe, first of all, has an education program. But one of the things, and Chris spoke about this briefly, is the duality of being a Native, and we tease a lot about it, because very facetiously, walking in two worlds, that's garbage. You know, we walk in one world. However, there are two very real perspectives. And being a Native person that's educated, I went to school, I went to law school, and if my whole goal was to go to school and go to law school, well, then I wasted my time because I didn't contextualize it around being a Native person or helping reciprocating that benefit to Native people. And so I think the struggle is not only to get educated, but how do you do it in a framework? And this is the part I don't think we've worked out. How do we do it within a framework that is consistent with Native values, that's meaningful to Native people, consistent with Native values, where you're not just learning to go out and be rich, but you're learning to go out and help the world, to bring that knowledge back to your small community, your tribal community, and it could be any tribe, it could be within a city context, but to make it sustainable. Because to me, it seems like right now we have a whole lot, irrespective of color, of educated dummies, of people who don't understand that there's this larger obligation. And that's what being tribal is about, is having this larger obligation. It's not just about me and improving my own lot in life, but instead making things better for the surrounding community. And so I can't take that question in a vacuum of just how do we improve the education. I have to think about it in the context of how do we improve the values within our own small communities that makes people. You can't lead a, you know, what they say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. But you can make them thirsty. So how do we make, it's true, I've seen it.
Run them around.
So how do you make, and this isn't just Native people, how do we make them thirsty so that the goal isn't, they're not just thirsty for being rich, but they're thirsty for learning some sustainable skills to build up our own communities, you know, within these small frameworks.
First of all, I just want to say, in our commission, we support the recognition of the Duwamish tribe. That was a terrible injustice that happened in 2001. In terms of education, one thing that's important is that, you know, as a school, we've been involved with the school's got a new strategic plan. They're putting that together for the next 5 years. So we want to incorporate, you know, a native presence and native culture, like Sweetwater said. You know, want to preserve the programs that are there, but actually make them better. And so, you know, it's not that we want to have a sort of a worn down, beat up, you know, Indian heritage school. We actually want a really nice new one. that's a really important thing. So.